From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, it's The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, streaming services are spending billions on content. Studio musicians want more for playing the scores for all those series and movies. Then we visit a new show at the Annenberg Space for Photography that takes up one of President Trump's favorite topics, walls.
Take a moment to think about, why do we do this? That the anxiety to build these walls has been going on for as long as there's been human civilization, but to what end?
And we hear from a young singer-songwriter who'd rather read science fiction than listen to music. All that coming up on The Frame. Online streaming has revolutionized how audiences consume content, but there's still a lot up in the air about how the creators of that content are paid by streaming platforms. The union representing musicians is negotiating a new contract with the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, which represents production studios like Disney and Netflix. And the American Federation of Musicians has a new demand for musicians who record the score for the most popular streaming shows like The Handmaid's Tale. Here's some of that series' score. Musicians want residuals from streamed content. John Burlingame wrote about the issue for Variety, and he joins us from the Variety newsroom. Hey, John, welcome to The Frame.
Thanks, John.
So how has it historically worked for older platforms when musicians' work appears on things like DVDs or on TV?
Well, for a long time, the musicians who play on the scores, if it's recorded here in the United States, for example, one of the Star Wars pictures, or the last one that which was recorded here, goes to DVD or to cable or to what they call a secondary market. So the musicians then are paid again on a kind of sliding scale for the work that they did the first time. The concept is that the musicians who helped make the project as successful as it was deserve to share in the success.
And that hasn't translated to streaming. So let's say, for example, I'm playing violin on a John Williams score for a Star Wars movie. That's going to do a lot of business in theaters, and then once it hits DVD and other ancillary markets, I'm going to get a little check. But let's just say the new Disney Star Wars thing is only going to be on Disney Plus, its streaming platform. Am I going to get anything for playing violin on that score?
And the answer is no. For example, as I pointed out in my story this week, The Mandalorian is being recorded here by American Federation of Musicians players, but it's a straight to a streaming platform, and their contract doesn't cover that in terms of a potential future payment.
The Musicians Union says that a lot of its members are taking a huge pay cut. Is that because so much content now is either created for streaming platforms or is doing the bulk of its ancillary sales on streaming platforms?
It gets a little complicated. And, you know, to be honest, I'm not sure I fully understand the complexity of how it all works. But it is true that the musicians are saying that because two-thirds of their income currently is from residual payments from many different previously negotiated clauses, that if they don't get a percentage of the streaming success, as they're asking, their ultimate wages, what they make on a monthly or yearly basis, will be plummeting because so much material is now being generated for streaming platforms.
We're talking with John Burlingame at Variety. And does it feel like musicians, when it comes to the pecking order in Hollywood, are a little bit, if not way below, what writer, directors, and actors are getting from residuals from streaming right now?
Yeah, there's no question about that. The actors, writers, and directors negotiated what they call new media. It's not really new anymore, what they call, in terms of contracts, new media payments. That's been done for years. So they've been receiving residuals, but the musicians have not. This goes back to the 1980s when the musicians first sought these additional residual payments and were denied those numbers by the producers.
I think the main difference, though, is the amount of money that's being spent on production. If you look at just Amazon and Netflix this year, there's probably about $20 billion that is going to be spent on producing and acquiring content. So when the musicians go in to try to negotiate, they can certainly say, you guys are spending a lot of money. We deserve a little bit of that. But do they have much clout at the bargaining table?
That remains to be seen. It's interesting. This week's rally was supported not only by fellow musicians, but by leading people within both the Writers Guild and the SAG-AFTRA union. To what degree that will make a difference, I think no one really knows. You know, one of the interesting aspects of this to me is that singers are represented not by the musicians' union, but rather by SAG-AFTRA. So singers who are performing, let's say, perhaps just doing oohs and ahs in the background of a score, will in fact receive streaming residuals over the next several years, whereas the people who actually prepared the parts that they sing from, the AFFM members, will not receive a dime.
So have we heard yet what the argument is from the other side of the bargaining table, from the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, about why they shouldn't start paying residuals or those residuals should be limited in scope?
We haven't heard anything from the AMPTP, which represents all of the studios and these producers at this point. Musicians who have told me privately that they expect it will be an uphill battle because the producers are going to take the position that musicians have never had a streaming residual in television and therefore why should they get it now? I think that the musicians have a stronger argument than ever, and the fact that they're backed by not only other unions, but in fact by they got letters of support this week from a number of members of Congress. So perhaps that will carry some weight. I think it remains to be seen.
It feels like this is somewhat parallel to the argument we're hearing from singers and songwriters about streaming music sites like Spotify, that there's been tremendous growth in the amount of subscribers and money spent on those kinds of platforms, but the creators of the content aren't sharing in the spoils at all. Are these arguments somewhat similar between what film composers and musicians are saying and what singer-songwriters are saying about streaming platforms like Spotify?
I think there is a relationship. Over the course of the last 20 or 30 years, music, sadly, has been devalued in our culture in many ways. And those people who create this wonderful music that we listen to, I think they need to be compensated. I think we need to think about that and remember that. And I think that the argument that is being made about how little money is being generated for creators on Spotify is relevant.
John Burlingame writes for Variety. John, thanks so much for coming on The Frame.
Great to talk with you, John.
You can find all the latest industry news at Variety.com. Coming up next on The Frame, there's been a lot of talk about walls recently. A new photo exhibit challenges us to see them in a new light. President Trump has consistently made clear that a wall along the U.S. southern border is one of his main priorities. In a briefing just yesterday, Acting Customs and Border Protection Commissioner Mark Morgan had this to say.
To date, a total of 71 miles of new wall has already been constructed. And it's not just a wall, it's a wall system, integrating lighting, technology, and access roads.
A new exhibit at the Annenberg Space for Photography looks at walls in all their forms, both physical and figurative. Jen Sudel Edwards curated the show. It's called Walls Defend, Divide, and the Divine. It includes the work of some 70 artists who photograph barriers around the world, from prisons to refugee camps to fences along the U.S.-Mexico border. When you first enter the exhibit in Century City, you're immersed in a sonic and visual installation.
It's a video by Tomas van Hutrev. It's called Divided. It sets the tone for how we want visitors to really navigate and experience the space. You're basically looking down at the water coming in, the breakers hitting the shore, and it's incredibly beautiful and so peaceful and so just the Zen state. And you have this line cutting down the center, which looks like any pier that you would see at any boardwalk. But then slowly as the camera pulls away, you realize that this is in fact the strip of the wall that divides the United States from Mexico, cutting into the Pacific Ocean down near San Diego.
I want to ask you about how you define walls, because
yes.
Before we start looking around, I'm looking at a number of images, and they're fences. They're barbed wire fences. It looks like there's a fence at Manzanar or another relocation
no,
camp,
you're right. It's
internment
Manzanar.
Camp.
Yeah, yeah.
When you were thinking about this show at its inception, how did you define wall, fence, border, barrier?
Barrier. It was really about the idea of walls, metaphorical, physical, literal, symbolic, as something that defines a space and restricts a space.
What were the first conversations you had about this show? What was going on in the world, and how did it start coming together?
So Katie Hollander, the director, is a very old friend and colleague. She was really excited about the idea that the Berlin Wall coming down, it's the 30th anniversary of the Berlin Wall coming down.
This November.
Yeah, November 9th. It's also the 50th anniversary of the British government putting up the peace lines in Northern Ireland. And there was, 2 years ago, a lot of discussion about starting to take those peace walls, the peace lines, down in 2023. So we're about to celebrate the Berlin Wall coming down.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight with Peter Jennings. Reporting tonight from Berlin.
From the Berlin Wall specifically, take a look at them. They've been there since last night. They are here in the thousands. They are here in the tens of thousands. Occasionally they shout, Die Mauer muss weg, the wall must go. Thousands and thousands of West Germans come to make the point that the wall has suddenly become irrelevant. Something, as you can see, almost a party on. How do you measure such an astonishing moment in history?
Which was a formative moment in our lives. I mean, that was a huge thing. And growing up in the 80s, with U2 being one of my favorite bands, like Northern Ireland and the Troubles and the walls defining Northern Ireland was also a big part of my life. So the fact that these two conversations, celebrations, were so much a part of the international conversation going on, but then we also had this gearing up of build that wall and Donald Trump's campaign and the whole idea of further militarizing the border of the U.S. and Mexico, there was this weird disconnect. And so Katie was really interested in that tension between celebrating this moment when we were saying walls are not useful, they're damaging to society, they're damaging to a psyche, but then this international urging for more walls to be going up.
So walls can be physical, and in the case of something like Brexit, they can be political. So
yeah.
How do you find visual representation for a political idea?
So we have a great image of Banksy's
Let's go
graffiti.
Look at it.
Okay. So this is in Dover. You know, this is the emblem for the EU. And Banksy, you know, with his usual clever trompe-l'oeil, has painted a workman climbing up a ladder and is chipping away the symbols of the European Union from Dover, which is, you know, as you know, one of the entry points for that EU relationship.
Banksy also has a piece, I don't know where it is, that is essentially graffiti on a wall that says, it's a wall, get over it.
Yeah.
which is a really provocative idea when you start thinking about how people interpret and think about walls. What are the kinds of conversations that you are hoping to overhear as people are looking at some of these images?
Getting people to think about how to think beyond just the immediate fix, how to think about this broader problem. And I'm not naive. I know this isn't going to get everyone rethinking about inequities in this country and how to solve the prison problem or think about the immigration issues. But I do want people to think about the fact that this has been happening throughout civilization. And there are ways that we can take these political barriers, our personal barriers, and geographical barriers and see them not as permanent, but as things that we can actually work with, against, or overcome through some sort of absorption into our own behavior.
We're talking with Jen Sudol Edwards at the Annenberg Space for Photography. There are a lot of people in front of walls, and if I were to start spotting trends, I would say something that you appear to be caught by are not just structures, but people interacting with the structures.
It was a hard search to find images that conveyed the powerful presence of a wall without it being architectural or archaeological. And so having the human presence in there brought that humanitarian message in. And that's, at least for me, and again, this is just my view on it. But one of the reasons why I always loved coming to the Annenberg Space for photography when I lived in Los Angeles was because I felt like it was this moment of using photography to highlight the human condition. And that was something that photography historically was hopeful to do. That was something I always had in mind. How do you capture the human condition in the photograph? And so often that includes having humans.
And walls, like art, can mean different things to different people. Mm-hmm. And as you were finishing up the installation of the show, the New York Times came out with a story about Donald Trump's ideas for the wall.
Well, breaking news tonight, an exclusive report in the New York Times documenting the lengths to which sources say President Trump was prepared to go to stop migrants crossing the southern border.
He wanted the wall electrified, with spikes on top that could pierce human flesh.
The New York Times reports that privately, the president had often talked about fortifying a border wall with a water-filled trench stocked with snakes or alligators.
I'm going to quote from the story. After publicly suggesting that soldiers shoot migrants if they threw rocks, the president backed off when his staff told him that was illegal. So even as you have put together the show, the conversations around the wall have certainly changed dramatically in the intervening 2.5 years, haven't they?
The urgency of the exhibition absolutely ramped up over the last 2 years, particularly during that government shutdown. But it also made, I mean, I'll speak for myself. It made me more anxious to make sure that the show was as powerful, but also as thoughtfully provocative as possible, because I really did want to make sure that we had a balance of all continents, of as many time periods as possible, as of as many motivations as possible, so that people would, again, like, take a moment to think about, why do we do this? That the anxiety to build these walls has been going on for as long as there's been human civilization, but to what end? I mean, to what purpose? And as we're getting so anxious, not just in this country, but internationally, I mean, a third of the nation states of the world now have barriers on their borders. That's extraordinary. It's not just a U.S. issue. And so this is a phenomenon that's in the international zeitgeist. How is humanity going to continue all of this broad globalization and internationalism that the internet has introduced into our lives and travel when we're so manically every month seeming to want to define our territories more and more?
That was Jen Sudol Edwards, the curator of Walls, Defend, Divide, and the Divine. It's at the Annenberg Space for Photography through December 29th. Up next on The Frame, singer-songwriter Niloufer Yanya has a thing for science fiction. Now the London-based singer-songwriter Niloufer Yanya. She's currently on tour with her first full-length album. It's called Miss Universe. Along the way, she's performed on NPR's Tiny Desk, as well as The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. She brought her guitar to The Frame Studios and spoke with producer Jonathan Shiflett about her music and about finding inspiration on the road.
For inspiration, yeah, you have to really, like, find it, because there's nothing really inspiring about airplanes or cars. There's definitely interesting things to think about and interesting things happen, but it kind of drives you insane, like the repetition of everything. I've been reading this book at the moment about sleep. Sleep is actually so important for our body. At one point in the book, the person who's writing it asks why evolution, like, ever bothered to wake us up, because being awake essentially is damaging for your body, but sleeping is not. So that was quite interesting. Hi, my name is Niloufer Yanya, talking about my debut album, which is called Miss Universe. It's like a few things going on. There's like the songs themselves, and then there's also the interludes.
Thank you for entering your details, and welcome to Way Help, our 24/7 care program.
It's kind of like you're on the phone, you're on hold to a like health management company.
We worry about you, so you don't have to.
It picks up on the like themes, I guess, and the record about paranoia and like feeling like you're being watched and observed constantly. I'm definitely like, I gravitate towards movies and films and books with those themes, like Black Mirror episodes or books that are talking like about hypothetical future.
There is a sense of being watched. There is a sense of being followed.
People say anxiety, but it's not, I don't know if it is anxiety. I think it's more just reality, like different perception of reality, or like the kind of reality that people don't talk about.
Congratulations. You have been chosen to experience paradise as part of our What Will You Experience giveaway.
When people say mental health, it's like interesting because it's also, when you talk about feelings in a negative way, people are like, oh, it's mental health. But if you're just talking about being happy, no one would say, oh, this is about mental health. But really, like, everything is mental health when you're thinking, like when you're processing like an emotion. I didn't really know what I was doing for a while when I made the record, like what the whole point was. It kind of, once I recorded the interlude bits, they just kind of fit in to certain parts of the album, which made me feel better about everything. Sounds okay. I will come up with like the main riff and then maybe like a few lyrics. In paradise, play the press. Or more like, there'll be some words in the melody that kind of just are there naturally. Just like when you sing things, it's like, it sounds like you're saying something. And then different words will come out. And then I listen back to the recording, and I'm like, okay, that's interesting. And then I'll write the rest of the lyrics based around that.
Ooh, with all these sounds, I behave every day if only made sense. Ooh, what you're getting at? Do this anyway.
So that's like the verse, and then the chorus is,
this is what it feels like. I'm not sure I feel it tight. Do without talk, go without a celebration. Think it might take me a week to recover.
There is a specific like 80s sax sound. The instrument itself doesn't sound like the 80s. It's just, it sounds like a voice. That's why I like it. But it's kind of like guitar. You need to be careful with guitar. You don't want it to sound too, when you go for like distorted sound, you don't want it to sound too like cheesy, basically. When you sing, you got to be careful when you sing. When you play piano, you don't want it to sound too like, oh, it's a ballad, or when you put like keys in. So it's the same, it's kind of, it's just the same rules. And those things, it's just, they just gradually like change and evolve over time. Like, I would never have put any distortion on my songs like two, three years ago, but now I love it. Okay. Ooh, that bit. Ooh. Ooh. Heavyweight champion of the year. When I first started doing it, I didn't think it was very good. So maybe it's just persevering with ideas that are really simple and you're not trying to like overcomplicate it. Yeah. That was another interesting one because this song I had a very rough like version of it, and straight away I was actually working with Jazzy Bobby, who's in my band, and we recorded like a small demo out of it. I went away and wrote it again, and then we like made another demo, and then like keep writing it, and like then I play it with the band, and then we'd like do another arrangement. So it was like developing in a different way. But it's probably, I think for me, it's probably like one of my favorite songs. It's like one of the songs where like I felt like I got what I wanted it to do.
I'm tired from all these dreams, lack can't sleep, I'm still wired.
Generally, the ones that I think are the best are the ones that everyone else agrees that they're the better ones. Or you can just tell in the crowd, everyone actually listens. Or like everyone's like, oh yeah, this is good. Yeah, it's just like a different feeling in the room.
Nilufer Yanyo's music can be heard on your preferred streaming service. And that is it for today. Remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn at the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We'll see you back here tomorrow.